and criticism that we don't usually associate with patriotism. I mean, we usually somehow there have been a large number of very good sentiments taken over by what I would call domesticated into sentimentality. I mean, they were authentic sentiments. So that patriotism in its original sense was a kind of loyalty and love which led you to meet the needs of the country and care for the country, not whitewash the country or not at worship the country. And so that I would argue that an authentic patriotism leads to a kind of prophetic criticism of the situation in much the same way. And I would argue that in some sense a prophet is a reflection of the critical edge of Yahweh. That in some sense the great aspect of Yahweh that the prophets acted out was Yahweh's capacity not simply to open up the possibilities of prosperity, but also Yahweh's involvement in interpreting limits and interpreting short-term prosperity hinges on using everything up. Long-term prosperity hinges on a collaboration and a cooperation not only between persons and communities, but between human communities and the community of nature. If you have eggs, you know, if you have eggs and bacon for breakfast every morning, if you have so many resources and only so many pigs, and if you have bacon for breakfast every morning, maybe there'll be 3 quarters of the year where you won't have any bacon. And so that there's really a difference between short-term prosperity and long-term prosperity. Short-term prosperity involves really, you know, and I suppose in Israel, short-term prosperity involves getting as big a crop as fast as you can. Long-term prosperity involves making the soil last long enough and over a period of time. Short-term prosperity involves getting as much oil as fast as you can. Long-term prosperity involves really getting several sources of energy which will enable you to use your energy over a long period of time. So that I really see in short-term experiences of Yahweh are experiences getting picked up and out of the dumps. Long-term, what the prophets sort of discovered was that Yahweh was Yahweh not simply for one era in the life of the nation, but that he had a commitment to their people that would enable them to survive over centuries and survive really the destruction of the people, because in 722 you really, or in 922 you really had a split apart of Israel and Judah and this sort of thing. Now, as we get into Isaiah 9, so I guess I'm would argue that one label that would be good for the whole series would be Isaiah Judas Patriot, because he is telling them, he is both challenging their security and complacency and asking them to think more deeply about how to deal with short-term, the destruction of the country. And the other side of it is that there are some visions of long-term restoration and rebuilding. So that patriotism for Isaiah involves really mediating truthfulness, even if truthfulness is criticism. And I guess I would argue that when you're afraid to tell the truth, that's sentiment. The good qualities turn into sentiment. And there really needs to be a good exchange of truth, even if it leads to conflict, and there needs to be good criticism if there is to be long-term prosperity. So the real irony, if you're a insecure leader, and I don't think it makes any difference whether it's president of the United States or manager of a corporation or pastor of a church, if you're an insecure leader, you will surround yourself with people who tell you what you want to hear. And if you're a shrewd leader, you'll surround or include in the people that surround you people who will tell you what you don't see. And in fact, be telling you what you don't want to hear. And so that the leader who has as part of his team the people who tell him the kinds of things that either he doesn't see or he doesn't want to see will be able to forge a much, much longer period of productivity than the one who hears only what he wants to hear. The other theme that one might take for all of this is God's politics. God's politics. Because I would argue that the major theological stance of Isaiah is that Yahweh is himself providing the meaning, and Yahweh's strategies are what enable Israel to deal with the realities of their life and future, and are what enable them to interpret and what renders intelligible some of the choices that they have to make. And put quite simply, that God is the kind of a God who gets mixed up in politics. This was the covenant tradition. The Constitution of Israel was an agreement made between the people of Israel with God. The preaching in Israel is preaching about Yahweh's, and it is a preaching that on the one hand grounds Israel in a fundamental level of Yahweh's being, and on the other hand involves Israel in rather concrete decision-making about the politics and future of the country. And in some way, I would argue that one of the hard questions from we had a little discussion about where are prophets now, and one of the hard questions was what difference does Christ make to prophecy? And this is a question I'd enjoy wrapping with some of you about off and on through the week, because I think it's a very hard question, and I don't want to pretend to answer it, because I don't have answers to that question. I'd like to collaborate on answers, but one of the analogies that strikes me is that in some sense God's involvement in the politics of Israel, God's involvement in community in this period, is a bit of a preview of God's involvement in the personhood of Jesus in the New Testament era. So it is not the case that Israel knew nothing of God's intimacy and involvement in human affairs. Israel very well knew Emmanuel, God's presence in human affairs, so that there is some precedent. And the early Christians would not have understood how fully God was involved in the personhood of Jesus, in human personality and human flesh, if they had not really been reared in Israel, where they understood how God could get his hands dirty. And so, in fact, the spiritual Christians, the Gnostics of the New Testament period and later, had very intricate ideas of the incarnation. They just could not believe that God could be present in something fully human. So they had very elaborate theologies about how God put on Jesus. And one of the best of the Gnostic slogans was that God was incarnate in the Virgin Mary like water through a pipe. You know, Jesus was then a human outside, but really God, with a human form, only a human form. And the Catholic Christians really insisted that no, Jesus was fully human, and he wasn't a human outside with a God inside, but they wanted to affirm that he was fully divine and fully human, which is another story. And the other one was that some of the Gnostics, when the Lord on the cross, they exegeted the text, "Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit," as Jesus giving back his divine spirit to Yahweh. So that they had a very neat scheme. Yahweh was with Jesus after he was born and before he died. Jesus was divine after he was born and before he died. So God didn't really get his hands dirty. But the Jewish tradition really was what prevented the early Christians from buying this. Because from out of the covenant and Israelite point of view, it was quite clear that God was not afraid of getting involved in human affairs. So there is, from the Old Covenant, the thrust of Yahweh's word and activity is to confront fully the human situation, not to run away from it, or not to split it into a bad part, which we don't look at. So that if one really wants, as far as I can see, if one wants to look for the continuity in the prophetic word, the continuity is in Yahweh's consistent confronting of the fully human condition. Yahweh's consistent confronting. The only way to make sense of how chapter 8 is all about the destruction of Jerusalem and chapter 9 is about rebuilding the new kingdom, you know, the new deal. Chapter 1, the end of chapter 9 is about how the kingdom, about how Assyria is going to get flattened, and chapter 11 is about how the new kingdom is going to get started. Now, those are two opposite statements from the prophet, and the only way to make sense of that is to see each of those as a consistent response to human need, almost like, and the human situation of Israel, almost like a parent who says yes to one request of a child and no to the next request of a child, but the parent is perfectly consistent. The parent is perfectly consistent in acting for the development and growth of the child, but one time it's yes and one time it's no. So the words of the parent are reversed, but the intention of the parent is consistent. So that the prophets say words that are different, but they are affirming a constancy of concern from Yahweh for Israel that is perfectly consistent. So that on the one hand, they can say it will be destroyed or it will be built up, and on the other hand, they can say his mercy endureth forever. So I would look for what is consistent about the prophet's point of view is that they really believed the hymn book, his mercy endureth forever, or his faithfulness. But it's time to get into texts. I want to come back to 9:1-7 as sort of a Reformation and Restoration oracle, and maybe we can tie 9 and 11:1-9 together, because these are both full scale portrayals of the rebuilding of the kingdom. And there are some more judgment oracles, there are some more purification oracles that maybe we can look at a little bit more briefly. In 9:8-10:4, you have a perfect example of a wrath or judgment or a construction. You have it put together. It's a longer poem, almost a litany. You have it put together into four stanzas. You will recognize the stanza by the chorus. After each of the five verses, there is the phrase which you see for the first time in 12b. For all this, his anger is not turned away, and his hand is stretched out still. And you have that same phrase in 17c, for all this his anger is not turned away and his hand is stretched out still. And in 18, in 21b, and then in 10:5. So that you get a powerful repetition. I think sometimes instead of reading the prophets like theology, we ought to read them like music. If you feel like the prophets slip away from you, I would suggest that you simply take one poem and read it once a day out loud for maybe 6 days. Take one poem, read it once a day out loud for 6 days, till you begin to hear each of the words. And for example, in an oracle like this, there's nothing really subtle about the point that God's going to challenge their complacency and security. But the repetition, it's a hard message, and the repetition is so it'll soak in. So it'll get trickled down from the head into the consciousness and reorient a consciousness. So that and this is why some of these texts really are for singing and reading over a period of time, much like in a piece of music. We begin to hear it about the third time, you know. Every time you hear it, you add another variation on the theme that you didn't hear the first time. And so that by the time you've heard it five times, then it's yours. And so something of the same process. So if you don't know what to do with these texts, just read them out loud. Read them out loud. But they are poetry, and so they really need to be read so that you can hear the words, not just think about them. The Lord has sent a word against Jacob. Now, Jacob is the name for Israel, and one of the here's this is an interesting oracle, and I read this sequence just like I read the first, that big sequence in the beginning of Amos: for three transgressions and for four I will not turn away his anger. I will not turn away my anger. It's in Amos you have Ephraim and Moab and then finally Israel and finally Judah. And I understand in this case the first four stanzas, the one beginning at 8, the one beginning at 13, and the one beginning at 18, to be generally about Israel. Now, get it. Here, Isaiah's preaching in Jerusalem, and he's talking about Israel. Somebody's preaching in Washington and they're talking about Canada. Okay? And it's very easy to be instructed about what your neighbor's disasters. It's terribly easy to make sense of, you know, the breakdown of the British economy and this and that conflict in another country. All right, after that four stanzas of interpreting the fall of Israel, then there's a stanza which generalizes it. And in fact says, you know, look at what happened. You're sitting there saying, Yahweh did this for Israel, Yahweh did this for Israel. And then the last stanza is, you know, look, that can happen to you too. That can happen to you too. So the Lord has sent a word against Jacob, and it will light upon Israel. This is the northern kingdom, and all the people will know. Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria, Ephraim is another name for Samaria or Israel, who say in pride and in arrogance of heart, the bricks have fallen, but we will build with dressed stones. The sycamores have been cut down, but we will put cedars in their place. Oh, that's a fantastic quote, sort of from popular talk. Curious one. Now, the dress stones and the sycamores are for ordinary building, and the cedars are for luxury building. So note what's going on here. We've run out of one kind of fuel. We're going to use another one. We've run out of one building material. We're going to use another one. And so what this exhibits is the short term. Use it up. Live. Keep the standard of living going at any price, regardless of how much you use up. It doesn't really make any difference whether our great-grandchildren have to go boom to a lower standard of living. What really is important is that we keep the economy going at full steam right now, regardless of how much of resources that belong to everybody over a long period of time we use up. Okay, the kind of logic of that curious phrase. The bricks have fallen, but we will build dress stones. Say, if any of you need an annotated Bible, I think that the notes in the Oxford Annotated Bible are pretty good, and I think that the notes in the Jerusalem Bible are pretty good. And little things like the difference between the use of sycamores and cedars are in those footnotes. And if you miss that, there are a few things that you really need somebody to, you need right there or you'll miss the point. So that's a neat example of a kind of carefree use of the natural resources of Israel. The bricks have fallen, but we'll build with dress stones. The sycamores have been cut down, but we'll use the cedars. So the Lord raises adversaries against them, stirs up their enemies. The Syrians on the east and the Philistines on the west devour Israel with open mouth. They've been short-sighted. They've been short-sighted, and they're going to be they're going to be attacked from various sides. For all this, his anger is not turned away, and his hand is stretched out still. God is both the God of our prosperity and our limits. The people did not turn to him who smote them, nor seek the Lord of hosts. So the Lord cut off from Israel head and tail, palm branch and reed in one day. You see, even in some of these very straightforward oracles, the imagery of Isaiah just breaks out. And the elder and the honored man is the head, and the prophet who teaches lies is the tail. The people is the body in between, but the wise old men are the heads, and the prophet is the tail. And the Lord's going to cut off both of them. You know, this is one of Yahweh's strategies. Is to undercut when the leadership is not leading the folk in a critical direction. Then the leadership is vulnerable to extinction. One of Yahweh's political strategies is to throw out crummy leaders and get new ones. And it's just that blunt. The elder and the honored man is the head, and the prophet and the prophet who teaches lies is the tail. For those who lead this people lead them astray, and those who are led by them are swallowed up. Therefore, the Lord does not rejoice over their young men and has no compassion on their fatherless and widows, and everyone is godless and an evildoer, and every mouth speaks folly. From the prophet's point of view, the whole thing has soured. There is short-sighted economic strategy. There is uncritical leadership in both the leaders and in the prophets, the critics. And this sort of erodes away so that the whole society is godless and swamped. Now notice, Yahweh is dealing with the community. None of this special relationship between me and Yahweh. Yahweh's relationship is with the whole community. And this is how we deal with the difference between our sense of direct access and our sense of being individuals over against the community, and their very strong sense of kinship and community is I think a major issue in interpretation. For all this, his anger is not turned away, and his hand is stretched out still. There are times when things are really corrupt, where it is a great relief that somebody remains angry. When things have really gone awry, the great good word is that somebody is still trying to reform them. So when the whole people is off kilter, then it is good to hear that somebody is still working to change, to criticize. Somebody is still angry enough to care to do something. Most of us, when the whole ship is off course, just give up and turn stoic and go off in our own little track and try as best we can to salvage a little bit of space for ourselves. But the prophet's understanding of Yahweh is that he does not let go of the folk, even if the folk is going backward or off to some other place, but that there is a kind of healthy anger which keeps frustrating the folk into reform, frustrating the people into repentance and to change. Now, you'll notice one of the differences between each of these stanzas. They're all very repetitious, but they up the ante. Each stanza is more intense than the previous. So the first one talks a little bit about the condition that led to this alienation of the people from Yahweh. The second one talks a little bit about how bad it's gotten. The third one is a very vivid metaphor for destruction. And it's very, very vivid. It's fire, and there's nothing. You can just see how quick we jump for the little false alarm, and that is important because there is nothing that wastes faster and more deeply in woods than fire. There's nothing that wastes us and ravages us and rapes us quicker than fire. And this is the image that the prophet uses. For wickedness burns like a fire. It consumes briars and thorns. It kindles the thickets of the forest. They roll upward in a column of smoke. Not only does wickedness burn, the Lord's anger burns. So it's fire with fire. It's fire met with fire. Through the wrath of the Lord of hosts, the land is burned, and the people are like fuel for the fire. No man spares his brother. They snatch on the right, but are still hungry. They devour on the left, but are not satisfied. Each devours his neighbor's flesh. Manasseh, Ephraim, and Ephraim, Manasseh, and together they are against Judah. And for all this, his anger is not turned away, and his hand is stretched out still. Things are pretty bad. Things are pretty bad, but Israel is still in a dog-eat-dog frame of reference. Things are pretty bad in Israel. The wickedness has devoured them, the anger of Yahweh, through the Assyrian thing has devoured them, but Manasseh is still devouring, competing with Ephraim, and Ephraim with Manasseh, and both of them are against Judah. So that there is still a kind of internal conflict. There's an internal conflict between the sons of Abraham. That the two reactions to limits. One reaction is to just get fiercer and more self-interested. If there's only a little to go around, then I've got to get mine first. There's a shortage, and we hoard, and I'm going to take care of myself. So one of the initial reactions to limits is to make people more aggressively self-centered. And really to bring out more, to sweat out, almost like a sauna, more of the worst in people. Sometimes when the limits are creeping up on you, you go completely to pieces. Now the other reaction to limits is to change your whole orientation, to repent, to change your consciousness and your direction, and it suddenly dawns on you that what you're doing is only making matters worse, And that how one deals with limits fairly and broadly is quite a different thing than simply grabbing and taking and preserving oneself. So that, but the point is that this stanza ends up saying that here this place is ravaged, and it's still dog eat dog. So even the destruction of Jerusalem, even the destruction of Samaria, hasn't really changed the situation yet. And then the next stanza: woe to those who decree iniquitous. Now notice, it's no longer Jacob, it's general. Woe to those, and woe is a wonderful word in Hebrew. Oy! Oy! To those who decree iniquitous decrees, and the writers who keep writing oppression, to turn aside the needy from justice, and to rob the poor of my people of their right, that widows may be their spoil, and that they may make the fatherless their prey. The measure of the justice of the leadership is the attention to the dependent, the poor. One of the really important things to take a look at is whether government programs are reaching the poor or whether they are reaching the middle class people who vote. What will you do in the day of punishment, in the storm that will come from afar? To whom will you flee for help, and where will you leave your wealth? When the storm comes, and when the destruction, when Assyria comes to the door of Jerusalem, there's nothing to do but leave, and then all of the stuff that's been stored up is left behind. What will you do in the day of punishment, in the storm which will come from afar? To whom will you flee for help, and where will you leave your wealth? Nothing remains but to crouch among the prisoners. The only alternatives at a certain point are to die or be captured. The only alternatives at a certain point are to die or be captured. For all this, his anger is not turned away and his hand is stretched out still. Hard words, very sharply critical words, very astute words that take the plight of a neighboring country and make you aware of the possibilities of your own future. We have only to look at the way a number of the countries in Western Europe have exhausted their resources and outlived a colonial era. We have only to look at highly populated areas to know what an interdependent and fragilely dependent society we have. Let's take a look at, notice now that the total reversal of mood between Isaiah 9:8 and Isaiah 2, 9:2 through 7. And in some sense, one really thinks that 2 comes after, 9:2 comes after 9:8. Because 9:8, when what is lamented and projected in the second half of chapter 9 happens, then they will be ready for 9:2 through 7. The prophets, one of the great visions of the prophets, and you'll have this elaborated in von Rath's The Message of the Prophets, and there are a few copies in the bookstore. One of the great visions of the prophets, von Rath describes as reopening history. It begins to dawn on them or be revealed to them that God's going to do some new things. You know, he made the covenant and he kept them going, but that these are precedents, not exhausted events, so that there is still the possibility of God doing new things. Now, when they start thinking about what kind of things is he doing, going to do, what they come up with is they extrapolate into the future on the basis of the past. They see in the future new models of the past. So that Jeremiah sees a new covenant on the horizon, which is a redoing of the old covenant, and Isaiah, who's a royalist and in Jerusalem, sees a new king like David. So that in a certain sense, most of the messianic passages begin to take on their concreteness and their color when you see the connection between the Messiah and David. So, how will God shape it up? Well, along will come a new super king. And the one that really put Israel together had been David. And what will happen? Well, the results of this will be the kind of community of order and justice that they had briefly sort of sampled for some in the wilderness and for some at the time of David. So David is really the past golden age, and their language about what God will do in the future is determined by their memories of David. And it's interesting that this language is very important because it comes into the Christian tradition and is remarkably illumining of the way in which Christ rules and governs in the community. And so its language, it's hierarchical language that has made sense and been helpful for a long, long time. I don't know if it will continue to make sense in an egalitarian society. There may be a point at which talking about life in authoritarian structures may prevent us from seeing our responsibilities. But I'm not ready to say that we've come to that point yet. At any rate, it's a fantastic portrait, you go through all of this hard, heavy, critical thinking about the politics, and then you hit one of these passages. It's almost like, it's been rainy for a week, and all of a sudden the sun comes out and you can see the top of the mountain. You know, it doesn't last because, you jump from 8 and here's this fantastic vision of the top of the mountain, and then you're back having to separate back at the nitty-gritty, having to separate the tailings from the ore, and separate the cans and the pots and the paper and the wet garbage from each other, and down to the nitty-gritty of trying to keep the country going, but it just changes the whole, there's a point at which you get exhausted by how bad everything is, and you just need desperately to hear or to see the vision of Yahweh's sort of restoration, final restoration. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shined. Deep darkness, those dark, dark nights. Most of the time darkness isn't so dark. I mean, there's sun, there's moon, and there's stars. But every once in a while, when you get that high fog that blocks out all the stars and the moon,
then there's deep darkness, and it's just black. Thou hast multiplied the nation, thou hast increased its joy. They rejoiced with before thee with the joy at the harvest. When the grapes are being divided up, and harvest in Israel was wild. You know. It wasn't just wheat, it was grapes too, you know. And they made the wine and they really enjoyed it. It was harvest is happy. You know, and most of us, I suppose those of you who are in rural areas really, really can just smell the excitement of that. Most of us who, you know, I grew up in a city and saw my sheep at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. you miss the power of this. With the joy at the harvest. And as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. This is a little sour analogy, but in those days, there wasn't nice regular pay and GI Bill and all these regular benefits for the soldiers, and so that in fact part of the pay for the tax collectors in the armies was what they were able to collect along the way. You know, the tax collectors went to Caesar and said, "I'll collect taxes in Israel for such and such an amount, and if it's a good emperor, he knows that that's too high and he can't collect those taxes without exploiting the people, so he takes the medium bid. But if he's hard up, you know, and has a few extra wives and a few bigger palaces to maintain, then he takes the highest bid, and then the tax collector goes out and really, really squeezes it out of people. And that's the way the armies work too, so that's when the guys get their pay. So they rejoice, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden, and the staff for his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, thou hast broken as on the day of Midian. The imprisonment of the people has been broken. There's been liberation. For every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult, and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. Fantastic. The army boots and the army clothes aren't going to be saved for the grandchildren. They're going to be rolled up and burned. They're not going to be needed anymore. Every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult and every garment rolled in blood will be burned for the fire. Government's going to go on. For unto us a child is born, a son is given. This makes sense in terms of there being a new king for the dynasty of David. And the dynasty of David, after all, was the concrete stability and sign of God's presence. And the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called with the names that go with Oriental kings: Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end. Notice, for most of human history, that where people and communities lived on the brink of chaos, order was the means to justice and peace. So we live in a very peculiar time where law and order have come to mean a kind of repression and exploitiveness, a suppression of dealing with problems. So that in order to get these people straight, you have to understand that order is a means to justice. And what is important is the goal of justice and peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end upon the throne of David and his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The Messianic King is not an end in itself, but the Messianic King provides the government which ushers in the era of justice within the country and peace between the countries of the world. So that the expectation is clearly that God will be about again after the Holocaust, the rebuilding of just societies and the establishment of a peaceful world. And when you hear so much about how Yahweh gets his hands dirty in refashioning folk and societies, it's a great hope and encouragement to see where it is all going, what the end of the affair will be. And the end of the affair is to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from this time forth and forevermore.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.